Technology.
Stories.
Media.
Connections.
World.
Download.
RN.
And good morning. Welcome to a fresh and sparkling week of Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell, happy to be in the chair with you for the next hour on RN. Coming up, creationism in the science classroom. Yes, indeed. Also, would you sign up for this experiment? You will be under constant surveillance. You will be shut away from the world for 7 full days. No coffee, no TV, no internet, no clocks. And you will be deliberately deprived of sleep. Yes, precious, blessed sleep. This sounds like some sort of setup for an interrogation, doesn't it? It's not. It's all in the name of art, in fact, and 4 artists have said yes, please. Also on the show, the Resilient Royals. That's Life Matters. Don't forget we're on Twitter at RN Life Matters. Tweet away on whatever you hear today and our Facebook page too. Our listener feedback line 02 833 1430. Well, first up, religion and how it gets taught in Australian state or public schools. This is controversial, even more so because it seems religious education is finding its way into the science classroom in some schools. You may know that in primary schools around the country, the State Education Acts allow for religious instruction or religious ed to be taught for an hour a week by church or religious representatives. They don't need a qualification in education to take these classes. And these classes are meant to be an opt-in scenario. Parents are to have a choice about whether their children attend. Well, it appears that in some state schools in Queensland, creationism, the belief that the Christian God, rather than the process of evolution, created the earth and all life on it, is entering the curriculum and possibly the senior science curriculum. Disturbing and distressing is how one high school science teacher describes it. Louise, that very science teacher, joins us this morning anonymously. Welcome, Louise.
Good morning, Natasha.
And also joining us is Kevin Bates, President of the Queensland Teachers Union, and Dr. Catherine Byrne. She's co-convener of the Religion, Ethics and Education Network of Australia, RENA, and she's part of an advisory group to the Australian Curriculum and Assessment Reporting Authority reviewing the place of religion in the national curriculum. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Good morning, Natasha.
Good morning, Natasha.
Catherine, I'll start with you. Certainly Australian state schools are allowed to have religious ed. What's different about Queensland, though? Can you give us some historical context here?
Sure. Early legislators in Queensland were actually very progressive. In fact, the first Queensland Parliament argued for religious tolerance and liberal democracy. But in 1910, a campaign was run by the Bible League, which was strangely partly supported by American preachers, and that resulted in the word secular being exorcised out of the Education Act. So that means in Queensland, the Lord's Prayer is said at school assemblies and that teachers and principals can teach Bible classes as part of mainstream curriculum.
So secular hasn't made its way back in?
No, people assume that it's still secular, but that's a mistake, and in fact, even today, the Queensland Education Department provides Bible lessons on their website for teachers to use, and principals can use those.
Catherine, Education Queensland has given us the statistic that 79% of parents leave the question of religion blank on enrolment forms, and 9% nominate no religion. That's a lot of blank space on those forms. So what proportion of students end up in RI, or religious ed, classes?
Yes, well, a lot of strange things can happen in the blank spaces. It varies, but most schools that I've been talking to parents in, about 80% or in some cases 100% of children are placed in RI by default because of a particular preference of either the principal or the religious education coordinator. And many parents are actually unaware of the kind of teaching that happens in those classes. So really the opt-in is a farce. It's through practice, it's a disguised form of religious conversion, or at least coercion.
Well, that's a very strong statement to make.
Well, that's happening.
Louise, I want to come to you. You're a science teacher at a state high school. And your specific concern is about creationism and intelligent design being taught in biology classes, senior biology classes, as science. Can you explain your concern?
Yes, at the school where I teach, in the evolutionary section of the biology course, the assessment task handed out to students asks for an analysis of evolutionary theory and creation theory. The task is designed to expect students to give them equal weighting, equal research time, and equal credit. And this assessment task, and something similar I know, has been going on for at least 13 years. There's two issues here. Creationism is a religious concept, and it's entering the science classroom. And the second one is every child in that room is being exposed to theological material without parental consent.
And what basis are they assessed on that particular assignment?
There is a guideline criteria sheet that goes with it where you have to acknowledge research sites that they quote, scientists that they quote within that material. The problem is that all of the sites and access that they have for developing their response to this task automatically lead through to religiously based material. So in actual fact, as part of that task, 50% of the research time has to be devoted to sites that are specifically devoted to creation science, an oxymoron I might add, and they have to then give that credit and discuss it at a 50% level with acknowledged widespread peer-reviewed evolutionary theory.
Have you had to teach that class?
Yes.
And what's been your response, or what is the response of you and colleagues as science teachers to having to treat that to teach that material in a science classroom, a senior science classroom?
It raises all sorts of complexities, Natasha. First of all, you diminish the value of the science you are teaching by the issuing of that task early on in the term. So you've already put a doubt within the student's mind of any future science. The students themselves then become focused on the task, because these are young people who are heading to university, so they're constantly questioning you throughout the genuine science curriculum you're teaching with creation-based questions. In addition, any school within the state system has a range of faiths within the room. So you are then treading on this cultural minefield in addition to the routine stresses that are occurring for any teachers under assessment loads, reporting loads towards the end of the year, trying to deliver curriculum quickly. And it just adds to the tensions within the room and diminishes the science of what you're trying to deliver.
Certainly makes it very hard for a science teacher to teach science. I mean, this is certainly a debate we have witnessed in the USA, Louise, a very heated debate with legal cases, high-profile legal cases. In Australia, less so. Education Queensland has said in a statement to us, Education Queensland follows the Australian curriculum, which does not support the teaching of creationism as a scientific theory and does not recognise it as part of the curriculum. And yet, your reality is very different. How can that be?
It's a complex web through a bureaucratic minefield. Within Queensland, we have syllabus documents that are the overarching documents that list the minimum standards for each of the two-year senior science courses. From this, each individual school then develops their delivery program, an approved delivery program that goes to the Queensland Studies Authority. Now, provided you meet the minimum science requirements of that syllabus document, it will get QSA approval. What happens is you can have a situation where an individual school then tags on or adds on additional material, but provided they meet that minimum standards, it will be approved. And within the state system, under our terms of employment, we have to deliver the QSA approved work program and assessment piece.
So material, creationism-based material slipping into the science curriculum, despite what, in fact, the Queensland Studies Authority has told us, they're a separate body which sets the syllabus, as you suggest, it approves the work programs that schools can individually develop, and they've told us that any creationism content would sit outside the curriculum, therefore would not meet their standards and so could not be accepted.
I beg to differ.
Kevin Bates, as president of the Queensland Teachers Union, how concerned are you to hear an account like that of Louise's of creationism being taught in science classes in a Queensland high school, and the evidence suggests that it's happening in more than one?
Yes, look, and it's, I certainly respect and acknowledge Louise's experience, and it is significant, I think, that the context and the background that you've provided does shed some light on the reasons for this occurring. And they are that legislation in Queensland clearly does not prohibit this religious teaching from happening in our schools. And it does leave it then in somewhat of a grey area and open to exploitation by those who have a particular agenda to push. So I guess my concern goes specifically to the notion, as I think Louise has very accurately described it, and that is that when we set a minimum set of content for the delivery of curriculum in the science area, for example, we do leave the door open in this particular context to there being a whole range of other strange ideas, or in this case, I guess, fairly mainstream religious ideas being infiltrated into the curriculum, and on that basis clearly causing some grave concern. But by the same token, I do have to note that if Louise's concerns are shared by members of the school community, then clearly it's open to parents and others in the community to raise those concerns in the school context, and there's a capacity to have that addressed by having that particular material expunged from the curriculum, because it's not required to be taught. It's being taught, I would think, to a certain extent, in a bit of a, I'll call it an underhand way, but that might be an unfair assessment, but by using the notion of critical thinking and comparative theory to introduce the notion of creationism standing beside evolution, there's a bit of a roundabout way of ensuring that particular concept is being taught.
Yes, indeed, and the issue is that this is happening in the science classroom, where creationism is given equal weight to evolutionary theories in a given assignment. And your point about parents needing to raise this issue, or indeed teachers needing to raise this issue, is a tricky one. Parents find it, in reality, very hard to raise these sorts of concerns with schools. Sometimes schools ignore their concerns, or parents are also nervous about their children being discriminated in the classroom, not necessarily in a malicious way, but just in the way that these dynamics work with schools. And certainly teachers seem to be concerned for their jobs in raising these concerns within their school or beyond.
And look, that's probably the most concerning part about this, because the divisive nature of this particular debate creates the sort of fear that you're indicating, and I think that's a very sad statement about our community. The parents would feel that in any way they should shy away from raising these concerns. Just shows the extent to which certain elements of the community are dominating in this debate. I mean, I think it's very clear that there are schools that are going down this particular path, and we've seen recent examples of high court cases where the whole notion of religious instruction and how that's being delivered in schools have been challenged, not the least of which has been around this very notion that we've been discussing about opt-in to classes and so on. And I think there's two distinct issues between the religious instruction aspect and the teaching of creationism in the science classroom. But having said that, the debate in the US mirrors this in terms of going to that highest level of the courts to try and resolve this issue. So clearly it's high in the community's minds.
Kevin Bates, is there any evidence to suggest that this emphasis has shifted with the new government in Queensland?
Look, to this stage, no. One of the concerns that we had very early on was when the state conference of the Liberal National Party in Queensland moved a range of policy motions that went to the very core of this issue, and that was they described the teaching of evolution as a reconstructionist scientist, that in some way it was beyond mainstream and deserved to be expunged from the curriculum. Now, that's extremism, that's fundamentalism at its most concerning. Fortunately, at the time, the Queensland Premier and the Education Minister immediately came out and indicated that That may well be LNP party policy, but it certainly was not the intention of the parliamentary wing to go down that path. Now, that's all good and well for the politicians to say at this point in time, but when you've got a political party with that sort of policy on the books to say that they don't believe that evolution should be taught in schools because it's not science fact, then that is taking us back more than a century in terms of our community and its thinking, and it is a grave concern that that could well become a reality at some point in the future.
Louise, as a state school science teacher, can you explain to us why science teachers aren't making waves about this issue? You've agreed to join us anonymously, but what are the concerns and why aren't science teachers more vocal about this?
I think the main concern is that if you have a program like this in place, and it's been approved within the school, then you have obviously got, as a minimum, middle management behind this documentation. And there is a fear factor associated with raising this too loudly. In the case of the school where I am, yes, approaches have been made, and basically we've been told that the program is QSA approved and you will deliver it. That basically brought any of our debate on the topic to a halt. And I will say that the discrimination concerns do raise their head professionally.
How so?
Well, your placement within a school, your timetabling within a school is dependent upon management. And there is a fear factor associated with staff raising these issues.
Dr. Cathy Byrne, co-convener of the Religious Ethics and Education Network of Australia, can you talk us through why parents aren't more vocal about this if they have a concern, as a number of parents have suggested that they do?
Well, parents are afraid. No parent wants to expose their child to discrimination or to ostracise their child. Not only are they afraid in wondering if that might happen, but some parents who have been brave enough to step forward, write letters to the education department or the minister, or sit down at a school council or PNC meeting, they've been basically stymied. The education departments in New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland, I've got documentation on cases where parents have asked for assistance to address this issue, but the actual education agency hasn't been able to help them, and in fact has made matters worse by telling the parents in some cases that if they take the matters further, they risk relations with the school. So there's not a great concern within the education agency itself for the parent situation. And I think that's really where the crime is here. There's not a real sense of compassion for the situation of the parents. If parents raised this at the school, one parent was told to just change schools if they didn't like the fact that their child was continually placed back into, for example, religious instruction. But the same applies for religion in the science classroom. If a parent raises this issue, they're absolutely the target of all sorts of, responses. And no parent wants to put themselves in that situation.
Or their children, more importantly.
And nor should they have to. It's really the education agency has a duty here and they're not stepping up to it.
Kevin Bates, President of the Queensland Teachers Union. If teachers are concerned but are nervous about speaking out about this issue, as indeed parents are, what is the Queensland Teachers Union doing on behalf of its members on this matter?
Look, I can honestly say that I've never had the issue raised with me directly. Now, that's not to say that it hasn't been discussed with others, but I would say, as in any circumstance where people find themselves in need of support, then obviously we're there to stand with them. What can we do? We're an agency that obviously has very strong industrial responsibilities to our members, but also very strong professional responsibilities, which includes this discussion about the curriculum. We're represented on the QSA board, and we're happy to take those issues up and have the discussions. Can we force an individual school to change the contents of its work program? Clearly, we don't have that sort of power. Parents do, community members do, and we're happy to work in concert with those those people to try and ensure that the content of curriculum being taught in schools is reflective of community expectations. But we also shouldn't be surprised that there's just as strong a view held by certain members of a community in support of this practice as there is for those who are in fact opposed to it. And in that regard, we do have a challenge in respecting the wishes of everybody concerned. And that's where the balance issue has to come into it. Clearly there is a place for exploring alternative theories, but they should be put in that sort of context. To be taught as science fact is quite a different scenario from a critical thinking exercise where we might explore and dissect alternative theories of the way in which our world and its every living thing on it has come into being, and allowing students an opportunity to think that through in a supportive and positive classroom context, because that's what's learning and that's how learning occurs in its best form.
Louise, a final question to you. The Queensland Studies Authority has also issued Life Matters with this written statement. It is normal practice for teachers to present different perspectives when teaching a required topic such as evolution. It is therefore possible for creationism to arise in a range of contexts such as an assessment task. For you, is that an adequate response?
No, it's not. I think from a teaching point of view, creation and evolution are two completely different frameworks. Students will raise questions within the classroom. They do come from diverse cultural backgrounds. I think to formalise it, and as occurred in this case, into an assessment task that requires quite in-depth research, quite in-depth critical responses from students with an equal balance in their response task, is a completely different situation to it coming up in the natural progress within the classroom when you're teaching evolutionary theory.
Look, thank you very much for discussing this issue with us. And I want to let you know that we've got the statements from Education Queensland and the Queensland Studies Authority provided to us on the Life Matters website. And also we asked for a response from the Education Minister in Queensland, and we are yet to receive a response on this issue. So, science teacher Louise, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on, Natasha.
And to Kevin Bates, President of the Queensland Teachers Union, and Dr. Catherine Byrne, who's co-convener of the Religious Ethics and Education Network of Australia, and who's written a thesis on this whole issue of religious education in state schools in Australia. Thank you.
Thank you, Natasha.
Thanks very much, Natasha.
And do get in touch if you've had an experience of this or have a view on the role of religious education in schools. We'd love to hear from you. Our website, abc.net.au/radionational, and look for Life Matters. And you can email us there privately if you'd like to. We'd very much like to hear from you. Our listener feedback line, 02833 1430. Coming up next, a very strange artistic and scientific experiment.
Counterpoint with Amanda Vanstone.
When was the last time you received a handwritten letter? When was the last time you actually wrote one? Handwriting is in decline, but if we lose it, do we also lose a bit of our own humanity? I think we might, but you can decide for yourself on Counterpoint.
This afternoon, after the news at 4, here on RN.
So make sure you join me each week and hear things from all angles.
Do you suffer from insomnia? It can be a fickle beast invading your nights, plaguing your poor, sleep-deprived brain with its callous ways. Certainly not an experience you'd think of as being conducive to creative practice. So here's an intriguing experiment. Four artists are about to submit themselves to a rather spooky experiment. They will live together in an enclosed space under constant surveillance, locked away from the world, not knowing if it's night or day. They'll be deliberately deprived of sleep and deprived of other things like coffee, tea, cheese, the internet, phone access. They're going to do this for 7 days. It's all in the name of art and science. It's called The Subjects, an experiment run by the Australian Network for Art and Technology, and it'll be hosted at the facilities of the Appleton Institute, which is Central Queensland University's sleep research centre based in Adelaide. And joining us are two of the artists, Tom Buchanan, a visual and performance artist, and Fee Plumley, who calls herself a techno-evangelist. She's currently travelling across the country in a big red bus, engaging with other like-minded artists. Welcome to you both.
Morning, Natasha.
Hi.
And joining us shortly will also be the scientist who heads up the Appleton Institute. Fee, you have a rather strange relationship to sleep. Tell us about the connection between sleep and creativity for you.
Well, I actually think, I mean, I was joking this morning with my friends saying that I didn't sleep very well last night, which is actually quite suitable for coming in and talking about sleep deprivation.
You don't get much sleep.
No, not really. I think that possibly my sleeping patterns, or perhaps lack of them, is what really drives my creativity naturally. So I'm quite curious to find out what somebody else trying to control my sleep patterns will do. I think it'll either drive me completely insane, or it'll actually help me recognise that I can drive my own creative practice in a much more constructive way. Or it'll stop me from being creative altogether. I'm not sure.
These are some of the questions that intrigue you. But come on, come clean. How much sleep do you actually get?
It varies. I've been at the Linux conference here in Canberra for the last week, so I haven't had a huge amount of sleep because so much has been going on, and obviously you're in conference sessions all through the day and then you have to catch up with your other work in the evenings, and obviously there's social events. So, you know, there'll be times when I don't sleep very much at all. I maybe get, you know, 3 or 4 hours a night, and then there'll be times when I just have to shut down completely and I'll spend a couple of days just sleeping as much as possible. So
it's probably totally not very erratic. Healthy.
Yeah, very.
This whole experiment sounds totally discombobulating and a little bit frightening, actually. Why are you subjecting yourself to it?
Because I think it's really interesting to challenge yourself. And I just think that being in a space that other people take away that environment of control. For a start, I mean, you know, I'm a geek, so I spent all my time online. And actually, my application for the project was me writing a story because I'd had a dream that had really spun me out. And so I was like, I woke up and the first thing I did was grabbed my phone and checked my email and then checked Twitter and then checked Facebook and then went back to just check email again to see if anybody else had replied to something. And I kind of, the whole context just really made me giggle. And I thought, what a ridiculous pattern of life I have. And then I remembered the sleep, the sleep residency is an application that the deadline was coming up soon. And I thought, actually, that would make quite a funny reason to explore this, is to be completely disconnected and see what it does to me.
Oh, yeah, interesting is one way to put it. Tom Buchanan, the original call out for this experiment by the Australian Network for Art and Technology said, turn the lens on yourself, become your own subject, experience total surveillance and authoritarianism in a controlled environment. What an enticement. Or what are you going to be doing?
I think I'm just going to see what evolves from that. So I'm going to start just looking at making drawings. And I guess with the sleep deprivation, I think it's kind of the surrealists looked at how sleep deprivation and starvation kind of creates new ways of thinking and stuff like that. So I think it'll be a challenge, but I'm really interested to see what the experience will come out of this.
Let's just be really clear. You are not going to be starved, but
I'm not going to be starved, no, but that's the surrealist movement.
But you will be sleep deprived. What have you been asked to do?
I'm just going to see if I can create a new body of work, I think, and see what that entails. I guess I'm going to keep it quite simple and tactile, so it's going to be like mark making and probably borrow drawings, I think, on small scales and probably scaling it up in a kind of matrix format, I guess.
Yeah, because
I paint oils as well.
Yeah,
so
you do big works too, works of urban environments and cities, don't you?
Yeah, the built environment's kind of the biggest trigger for my artwork, and I guess it's trying to find my place in the world. So I guess it's interesting within this context of the residency is, most of my work, I'm fed from a day-to-day living, like a bombardment of imagery and advertising, I guess, and being subjected to this without having, you know, telephones, internet, and, you know, that kind of imagery kind of sourcing. It's going to be interesting to see what I create. So
it might all,
intriguing.
It might more come from your imagination rather than
definitely,
the world
definitely.
Around you. And how are you as a sleeper? I mean, for Fee, sleep doesn't come easily or doesn't want to come easily, and she seems to be happy with that. What about you?
I think as I get older, I'm sleeping better. But the thing is, I think it's interesting because when I'm making a body of work for an exhibition, I kind of go crazy sleep patterns, and I think that's quite interesting because I guess the pressure of making stuff to show and et cetera is, I guess, and in some ways I want to see how that relates back to this residency as well.
Professor Drew Dawson is head of the Appleton Institute. Drew, welcome to Life Matters.
Hello, Natasha.
Now, look, I understand you don't want to give too much away so that the experience remains a surprise for the artists, but give us a clue about what the setup will be here.
Effectively, if you could imagine something like the Big Brother house without the swimming pool. and everybody keeps their clothes on. But
Well, we don't know, do we?
Well, that's always true, I guess. There's been a long history. Every Adelaide Festival for the last 10 years, we've had an artist in residence or something that we've done along the themes of the art of science. So in this particular project, the setup was to look at issues around the normal creative process and to simultaneously both isolate people and have them totally surveilled. So it has some allusions back to Foucault's notion of the panopticon, and to understand how the loss of sleep interacts with creativity. And we've seen, for example, in Tom's commentary that there is a long history of frenetic activity around a creative impulse. Mm. We've also seen that there's been a lot of work in previous years around understanding asceticism or going without as part of the creative or spiritual drive. So there has been a long history of depriving people in order to drive creativity and spiritual awareness. So in a sense, we wanted to explore that and to reverse how people normally experience the creative process. That is, we are isolating them and observing them simultaneously.
There's an element of cruelty to this. Depriving them of their creative source.
Well, that's the interesting question, is that a lot of people who are highly creative will tell you that when they are creative, the amount of sleep they get can be very low.
Mm-hmm.
And that process of being, in a sense, completely undistracted. And for most people in this day and age, this is an incredibly unreal experience, in a sense. That is, no TV, no radio, no newspapers, no internet, nothing except yourself and a few people who would be involved in the experimental protocol. So it's in a sense the hermit of the 21st century.
Yeah, that's a nice way of describing it. Drew, this is primarily an artistic adventure and project and experiment, but will you be taking any measurements along the way as a team?
Oh, absolutely, yes. We will be looking at a whole bunch of measures around alertness, creativity, fluency. So we've just finished building what is probably the best facility of its kind anywhere in the world. And this was a fantastic way with the opening and the festival to actually engage in something that the students will, I think, find much more interesting than normal science.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what do you want to look at? What do you want to measure? How will you measure it? You've got these people in a kind of container. What are you going to be applying them to take measurements?
We have a range. Well, I can't give too much away.
Oh, okay.
but we have a range of measures that measure aspects of brain function, including the ability to spontaneously generate ideas. That is fluency or creativity. And we're very interested in the relationship between sleep deprivation and creativity because the research literature on this is incredibly confounding. That is, there are people who will actually find periods of intense creativity associated with very poor or no sleep, and yet the research says theoretically you shouldn't be creative when you are sleep deprived.
Absolutely. Sleep deprivation compromises us on all sorts of levels, doesn't it, according to the science?
Well, that's a topic dear to my heart. I think there's a very singular perspective of that. I think sleep deprivation has very interesting impacts on human behaviour, not all of them negative.
Interesting indeed. Joining us on Life Matters this morning, Tom Buchanan, a visual and performance artist, and Fee Plumley, an artist and self-confessed techno-evangelist. And they are going to be part of an experiment which kicks off this week, at the end of the week, I should say, called The Subjects, in conjunction with the Australian Network for Art and Technology. And also joining us is Professor Drew Dawson, head of the Appleton Institute, which focuses on sleep research. Fee, interesting to see what the week will produce from you, given that so much of your creative output involves connectivity. Are you there, Fee?
Oh, yes. Hi.
Hi.
This is going to be particularly interesting because I've recently started a whole new type of work, and It involves things like Arduino electronics and augmented reality and locative media. So things like using OpenStreetMaps to create your own locational mapping. And so all of these things rely very heavily on having access to technology. And of course, because we're not allowed clocks, I'm not allowed to use any of my devices. So I'm going to have to bring books, which is wonderful. But all of my media, we were invited to bring a list of things. And they said DVDs and CD-ROMs. And I'm like, I don't have any. Everything I have is already digitized.
Yeah, that's right. Or it's in the cloud.
Yeah.
That's going to be strange.
Very, very strange indeed. I've asked everybody else to bring more.
What do you think you'll create?
I really don't know. I'm hoping that some of Tom's fantastic visual arts talent, because I know Tom's work from previously, so I'm kind of hoping maybe some of that will rub off on me and I'll start actually being able to sketch again, because I haven't sketched since I was 16. But otherwise, probably a lot of writing and probably a lot of knitting.
There is something delicious knitting. I love it. You're going to become a yarn bomber.
Absolutely.
If people don't know what yarn bombing is, it's one, those wonderful knitted structures that people are knitting around bits of public infrastructure these days. You might have seen them in your cities around Australia. Now, I mean, but also you have to extricate yourself from this wonderful national tour you've been doing in a red bus.
Well, the bus is still in very much in development. So, yeah, it's very early days. But, yeah, really big road trip is underway at the moment. So after this broadcast, I'll be heading back on the bus and then heading over towards Adelaide over the next few days.
Tom Buchanan, a number of you have blogged, and this is how Life Matters listeners will be able to track this whole experiment. They'll be able to track the blog associated with the project. But a number of you have blogged about your concern about, well, losing it, losing the plot, becoming psychologically, I guess, anxious in this situation or setting. And there's no doubt about it. I mean, the history of science is littered with similar experiments that have caused terrible distress for people. Is that a concern for you? I noticed that you all had to do psychological tests, for example.
I think most of my work's about me, or my performance work's about me in the status of making work and the tactileness of it. So I'm really interested to see what will happen. And I don't know, what I'm going to do is going to set up some restraints for myself and maybe some ethoses to kind of run out of. Like, so I'm going to try and do a portrait every day of myself. I'm going to try and get some kind of framework so I can actually get some routine and see what I'm really interested in, see what kind of body of work I make. And if I can make something, if I get away from my own work, which I'm prescribed to make normally, I think if I can go abstract and see if I can actually bring some other stuff out from that as well.
Well, good luck to you all four of the artists. And we can track you on a blog. I mean, how are you actually going to blog, by the way?
I don't know. Yeah. See, it's interesting because this is an interesting thing. I'm dyslexic, so my reading and writing skills isn't great, but I really love words, so it's going to be interesting working with these writers, which is exciting.
Yes, and you're in the space with writers. Yep. Well, look, can I thank you both, artists Tom Buchanan and Fee Plumley. Thank you.
Thanks, Natasha.
Thank you very much.
Good luck. Take care of yourself. And also scientist and director of the Appleton Institute, Southern Queensland's Sleep Research Institute, which is based in Adelaide, in fact. Professor Drew Dawson, thank you very much, Drew.
Thank you.
And you can keep an eye on how it's all going through the subject's blog, and we'll include a link on the Life Matters website to that. Well, you're with Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. Coming up, those resilient royals.
The Australian Red Cross and the Queensland Government have launched a joint appeal, seeking donations to help those affected by flooding. Funds raised by the Queensland Floods Appeal 2013 will assist individuals, families and communities directly affected by the floods and recent tornadoes. To make a secure online donation, visit redcross.org.au or call 1800 811 700.
We don't generally venture into the world of royal goss on Life Matters ever really, but we do often talk about families and resilience. And if ever there were a case study of families and resilience, it's the royals across the world. And you may have heard Queen Beatrix of Holland has decided to hand the Dutch crown to her son in April this year. This means she'll be ending 33 years of her own reign and more than 100 years, in fact, of female rule on the Dutch throne. Well, across the North Sea in the UK, Queen Elizabeth has, of course, been on the throne for over 60 years now. And in 2013, it might sound strange to you that there are, in fact, 10 countries in Europe where monarchies are still going strong. Their role may be mainly ceremonial, but my next guest argues their role shouldn't be dismissed. Peter Conradi is the author of The Great Survivors, How Monarchy Made It Into the 21st Century, and he's also co-author of The King's Speech. You may have seen the film. And he joined me a short while ago from his London office.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What do you think the monarchies across Europe, the remaining monarchies, bring to the countries they rule?
I think they bring a number of things. I mean, they bring stability, they bring a sense of tradition, they're an integral part of the culture in all these countries. And I suppose the most important thing is that they provide a head of state who is above politics. You know, he or she is not part of the political process. She is there, he or she are there, often for a very long period of time. Obviously, Queen Elizabeth has been there since 1952. Beatrix, who you just mentioned, has been there since 1980. So, you know, they provide continuity there. They're a symbol of the country who is there. And there's always this sort of feeling, I think, that when the political parties fall out among themselves, the president, if you have a president, the president gets dragged into it inevitably. When you have a king or a queen, they don't.
So for you, they are more than ceremonial.
Yes, they are, because they are an integral part of the political system. I mean, one sees that in Britain and indeed in Australia, and you see it in all the other countries as well. They have very, very important ceremonial roles. But if, for example, in the Netherlands, the monarch does have a role, for example, in the formation of governments. The same is true in Belgium. For example, you know, after an election, these are countries where they have a large number of political parties. It isn't very clear always who is going to form the next government. And so the monarch does get very actively involved in the process of appointing someone to sort of to sound out the political parties, then appointing someone else, a politician, to actually form a government. And, you know, they are quite actively involved in it, in a way that, for example, in Britain, Queen Elizabeth isn't.
What you're describing there is sort of an independent overseer, but are they truly independent?
I think they are. I mean, obviously, they are human beings. They will have their own political views. In almost every case, you know, they keep those views to themselves. I mean, if you were to ask me, Queen Elizabeth, is she conservative? Is she Labour? Is she left of centre? Is she right of centre? You know, it would be very, very difficult to answer. You know, and it's the same in other countries. Maybe there's a suspicion from time to time. Queen Beatrix's mother, Queen Juliana, was always said to be quite left-wing, against militarism, not very keen on sort of the traditional Dutch alliance with the Americans. But it's very rare that this ever translates into any action which will be perceived really to be unconstitutional.
Well, thinking about the Dutch monarchy, it is very interesting that Beatrix, she's in good shape, she's fit, you know, she's decided to abdicate the throne. And there's been a lot of conjecture about whether Queen Elizabeth in Britain should follow her cue. And many would argue, well, that's unlikely to happen with the British royal family. I mean, is the Dutch royal family quite a distinct entity in this way? And the fact that, I mean, we have Beatrix abdicating, her mother abdicated before her, and I think her mother's mother abdicated before her.
Yes, she did indeed. I mean, the Dutch monarchy is unique in this respect, or almost unique, because in Luxembourg, where they have a Grand Duke, they also abdicate. And it was kind of almost established by accident. Beatrix's grandmother, Wilhelmina, after the Second World War, wasn't in great health. She was quite old. She had a number of kind of political things weren't going very well. It was sort of the end of the Dutch Empire and so on. She abdicated, and in a sense, she set that precedent, which her daughter and her granddaughter have followed. Elsewhere in Europe, abdication remains very much a dirty word. I mean, obviously, in Britain. Well, I mean, in Britain, there are the memories of 1936, the enforced abdication of Edward VIII in order to marry Wallis Simpson. You know, this wasn't there's been, in a sense, a kind of a reaction against it. If, you know, if abdication hadn't had a dirty, wasn't a dirty word before, then it certainly was as a result of that. The same thing in Belgium after the Second World War. King Leopold III had a sort of a complicated war, let's say. His country was occupied by the Nazis, and there were feelings that maybe he hadn't done everything he should have done to resist. A lot of animosity towards him after the war. Mm. He too abdicated. But, you know, in those cases outside Holland, abdication is something that is a kind of a deviation from the norm. It's something you do because something has gone wrong. Whereas the conception of monarchy, certainly in Britain, is that the monarchy is somehow ordained by God. She's there, and it's a kind of a sacred duty which she has to fulfill all the way until death.
Mm. Peter Conradi is my guest this morning on Life Matters here on RN. He is the author of The Great Survivors, How Monarchy Made It into the 21st Century, and he's speaking to us from his London Times office. Peter, Australia is part of the Commonwealth. There's an ongoing debate here, as you know, about whether the Queen is relevant to us as a country anymore and what happens when she leaves her post. Is there any semblance of a Republican-type movement or an anti-monarchy movement in Europe?
There is indeed. I mean, in every country where there is a monarchy, there is a Republican movement. You know, it's not just in Australia. You know, we certainly have one in Britain called Republic. There are Republican movements in Holland, in Belgium, in the Scandinavian countries, in Spain, everywhere. Now, their popularity really goes up and down. It kind of fluctuates over time, and it seems to correspond largely to the behavior of the royal family from, you know, from time to time. So if that royal family is going through a good patch, then Republican support tends to go down. If the royal family is going through a bad patch, then it's, you know, it's boom time for the Republicans. So, I mean, for example, in Sweden at the moment, there's been quite a lot of controversy over the king there, and he's rather colourful sex life. Some rather lurid revelations have come out there in the last couple of years. There's the same thing going on in Spain, again, a king, not a queen, again, with a slightly lurid sex life. And again, this sort of same hit, plus a bit of financial corruption thrown in as well. And, you know, in both those countries, the Republicans are doing relatively well. But, you know, overall, if you look at the statistics, because there are lots of opinion polls that are done on this, typically support for the monarchy tens to be around the 70-80% kind of level, with the Republicans on about 20-30%. And there's a kind of a, you know, there's not just the individual behavior of the monarchs, but there's a kind of a life cycle that they tend to follow. You know, when you have a new young monarch, popularity tends to go up, particularly when they start to have children. There are all these sort of pictures of these sort of cute young royals running around. When they get into middle age and maybe the kids stop being cute toddlers and turn into awkward teenagers that do embarrassing things, then popularity tends to dip, you know, and then so it goes on.
Is there the same sort of paparazzi culture that pursues the European royals outside of the UK?
There is indeed. I mean, I was quite surprised, because I, working in the British media, thought that we were, you know, we were the real shockers.
And you are the real shockers.
But there are others that are even more shocking. I mean, I was struck by, for example, in Norway. Norway is, one would have thought, a very civilized, a very liberal, a very decent country. That's certainly what I thought, until I had a contact for the book with someone who wrote for one of their tabloid magazines, and he was describing to me the most extraordinary tricks that they got up to when they were pursuing the woman who is now the crown princess of Norway, Mette Marit, her name is. She had a very, very checkered past. She was actually a single mother when she married the crown prince, which was another first. She had a lot of experience or contact with the drug scene, shall we say. And they went to all sorts of lengths to find out about her past. They contacted lots of boyfriends. They paid an awful lot of money to find out lurid stories about her. They even bought up her father, who was quite a sad alcoholic character. They sent him into the wedding with a hidden camera to take pictures.
The father.
You know, I mean, really
How did the marriage, how's it gone?
Well, the marriage has actually gone remarkably well. She's transformed herself from a kind of a wild child, who in fact had some of her wildest period in Australia when she was there for a year.
Of course.
Picked up all sorts of bad habits, apparently, which she took back to Norway. And, you know, she's turned into an absolutely demure, perfect crown princess who one day will be a great queen. And, you know, by the same token, the Danish press very, very actively pursued Mary Donaldson from Tasmania, who, as I'm sure you know and your listeners will know, is destined to be the next Queen of Denmark. I mean, she had a terrible paparazzi problems.
So in all this, Peter, it seems to me that the European royals even survive some of the, you know, the ghastly scandals and seem to be a kind of more flexible bunch in terms of how they partner and who they connect with.
Yes, I mean, let's say the scandals, I mean, you know, human nature being what it is, I think the scandals are the same everywhere. I think they've maybe been quite relaxed about the choice of marital partners, certainly when it comes to the current generation of heirs to the throne, including Willem Alexander, who's going to be the new king of the Netherlands. You know, but there has been controversy about these partners as well. I mean, Crown Princess Mary had a very scandal-free background. That was no problem at all. In Sweden, there were problems, though, with the husband of the Crown Princess, who will become the Queen Regnant, the ruling Queen of Sweden. You know, he was her fitness coach, so there were a lot of questions asked about how appropriate it was for her to marry her fitness coach. Mm-hmm. In Holland, Willem Alexander's wife, who's Argentinian, there were some problems there because it turned out that her father had been a member of the junta that got up to all sorts of terrible things in Argentina in the 1980s. So that caused a lot of embarrassment.
It's real life, isn't it?
It is real life. And I think, you know, there is a sense in which while their parents were, you know, the current monarchs who are probably now in their 70s, 80s, were mostly marrying very carefully or marrying into other royal families, you know, the current generation now in their 40s, late 30s, 40s or so, have been much freer to marry whom they like. In the same way, in the sense that in Britain, Prince William could marry Kate Middleton, who, you know, was not aristocratic, who was not from a royal family. Clearly, she was just an ordinary middle-class woman.
Mm. Peter Conradi, thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters this morning to give us a much more nuanced understanding of the tradition of the monarchy across Europe. We appreciate it very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Peter Conradi there. His latest book is called The Great Survivors, How Monarchy Made It into the 21st Century. We'll pop the details on the Life Matters website, abc.net.au/radionational. Look for Life Matters. And yes, those royal stories, they are a resilient mob. Now, we've got some comments coming in already on our website and our Facebook page about our earlier segment on the question of whether creationism is being taught in the science classroom in some Queensland schools. Claire writes on our website, "Hi, I'm an evolutionary biologist and used to teach uni students. If this essay question arose in my class, I would take it as an opportunity to teach students about critically analysing sources, differentiating between real sources, i.e. peer-reviewed scientific articles, versus bogus or uncertain sources such as Wikipedia or religious sources. It's a very important lesson to have nowadays if intending to study science, and creationism is the perfect example for it, because there are no real sources supporting it," says Claire, and I have no doubt that others will have some different points of view there. So please do keep the conversation going on the Life Matters website, and you can always ring our message bank line as well, 02833 1430, 02833 1430. We're on Twitter too, at RN Life Matters. Mr. Michael Cathcart.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get arty with us after the news?
We are going to get arty. In fact, creationism is a good segue, because we're going to talk to Amy Espeseth, who grew up in a fundamentalist Christian community in Wisconsin. She now lives in Melbourne, and she's written a novel set in a very similar community to the one in which she grew up, and they hide some terrible secrets, the people in her novel. So we'll have a chat about that. And we're going to meet Chinese artist Song Dong, who is a big name. He's bought 10,000 household items to Carriage Works in Sydney. These are items from his own house. Put them in two huge containers, took them to Sydney, and they're on display. And I guess they help you reflect on the amount of stuff you've got in the cupboards at home. Have you got lots of stuff in the cupboards at home?
Oh, no, I've had to pare back a bit with a few house moves of late. But,
oh, well, you've been a mover, yeah. And that introduces discipline, doesn't it?
of a sort. Some people would beg to differ. But I have to say, Chinese contemporary art is extraordinary. Coming out not from the big centres either, some of the smaller centres across China.
And we're getting to know it.
It's totally exciting. I'm really excited about Chinese contemporary art. Thanks, Michael.
Good on you.
Coming up next on Life Matters, well, we're looking at finance in our purely practical segment and, sexual expression post-divorce. Bye.
For over a decade, Mali was Africa's democratic poster boy. But that ended in 2012.
French warplanes have bombed key towns in the West African state of Mali.
Are patrolling the streets of the northern city of Kidal, which had been the last rebel stronghold.
Campaign to destroy the Islamic strongholds after an appeal for help from Mali's president.
Where did it all go wrong for Mali? That's Rear Vision. You can download or stream this program from the RN website.